proposal for arbitration.
May it please the court, I'm W.S. Barron from Dallas, and I'm arguing here for the petitioner. And before I commence argument, I'd like to mention very briefly to the court one matter. I understand that very recently counsel for respondent have requested and have been granted 15 additional minutes to argue in support of their conditional application for Rivera, which was filed in this case. I don't think I'll need any more time. I've been allotted, but if I should need any further...
You have it, counsel.
All right.
You need it.
Thank you very much. This is an oil and gas case, and the suit was brought as a class action by the respondents, who are Jeff Hagen and others, and they're lessors and royalty owners in certain oil and gas leases covering lands in the Pittsburgh field, which is in Kemp County in East Texas. The suit was brought against various defendants, the only material one here being Texas Oil and Gas Corporation, which was a substantial working interest owner in these leases and is also the operator of the leases. Now, we have no objections to bringing or maintaining this case as a class action. I'll refer to the parties, if I may, as to the respondents, Hagen's as just the plaintiffs, and the Texas Oil and Gas Corporation as TXO, which is just an acronym for that name. The plaintiffs brought this suit in three counts, and the first was that they sought damages in the amount of $2 million, exemplary damages, and a like amount based on fraud allegedly committed by TXO and inducing them to execute division orders. Secondly, and in the alternative, and all three of these counts are in the alternative, they sought recovery of damages for $2 million as a result of Texas Oil and Gas Corporation's failure to pay them gas royalties based on the market value of the gas. Third, and in the alternative, they asked that the court enter an order directing TXO to account to them for the highest price, market price, obtainable from time to time, this being on the theory that TXO stands in relation to them in a situation similar to that of a trustee. Now, they also claimed that this count includes a claim for alleged breach of the marketing covenant by TXO, that is, the implied covenant in an oil and gas lease, where it's the duty of the producer operator to sell the gas and obtain a fair and reasonable price. They also sought statutory attorney's fees. This was a non-jury trial, and the court rendered judgment that the plaintiffs recover from Texas Oil and Gas, $1,075,000 as actual damages, that's all it called, and $300,000 as exemplary damages, and $250,000 as attorney fees. This appeal was taken to the Texas County Court of Appeals 6th District. That court affirmed the award of $1,075 primary damages. And it did it on the basis of the fact that Texas Oil and Gas had failed to pay the plaintiffs royalties based on market value. And that's very key here because the theory of it is this.
You said $1,075, you meant $1 million.
I meant $1 million. I wish I had said otherwise, John.
I get confused too when I talk about those big sums.
I wish somebody besides myself had been. In any event, this $1,075,000 award was upheld by the Court of Appeals, and it was on the theory that Texas Oil and Gas had failed to account for gas royalties at market value. And admittedly, they didn't pay market value for them, but the basis of that recovery lies in these provisions of the gas royalty clauses of these leases, which provide that on gas which is sold off the lease premises, that the market value should be one-eighth of the amount of the market value, whereas if it's sold on the lease premises at the wellhead, it's based on one-eighth the amount realized from the sale of the gas. And the way they got there was the fact that whereas this was a sale by Texas Oil and Gas Corp and others to Delhi Gas Pipeline Corporation, its wholly owned subsidiary, that sale should be disregarded or ignored because it was not a valid sale. Therefore, the first sale happened on down the line 1,500 miles away, respectively. That was the basis of the market value award. Now, the Court of Appeals also recognized that Texas...
I really pertinent for you to walk me through this point.
factually now, not legally, factually, how you say that the gas was not sold off premises?
How I say it was not sold?
Yeah.
All right, so we have a wellhead contract.
Okay.
Now, the sellers of the gas here, and there's never been just one seller. Texas Oil and Gas is essentially the main seller. In the early history of this production, for a couple of years, about half of it, less than half of it, was owned by a third party. They sold the gas pursuant to a gas purchase agreement to Delhi Gas Pipeline Corporation. It is a wholly owned subsidiary of Texas Oil and Gas. And the Court of Appeals reasoned that this sale was that you could disregard the corporate fishing because that this sale was using, I like to use its language, was that it was a sham sale to deprive the plaintiff royalty owners of their rightful royalties from a parent to a subsidiary corporation.
Well, to say that we reject that, is there any other way to say that there's still a sale off premises? In other words, Texas Oil and Gas is still in the picture, and they're selling it to, what was the name of the company they sold it to?
Delhi Gas Pipeline.
No, I know, but after that.
It's the International Paper Company and Southwestern Electric Power Company.
SWEPCO.
Yes.
Right.
I don't know of any other way except one argument, which is advanced by counsel for respondents that the Court of Appeals did not rely on, and that is that sour gas is usually sold off the lease premises. This is extremely sour gas, high BTU content. For that, he takes the testimony of a witness, the witness for Texas Oil and Gas, who was an expert witness only. You're getting the expert witnesses again, but I hope I don't have to rely on the testimony the same way. And in any event, he said most sour gas is sold at the tailgate of the plant, not all. He did not even purport to know where this sour gas was sold and was not called to testify for that purpose. Other than the fact that he testified to that, I don't know how it can be said that there's any other basis for saying this gas was sold off the lease premises. The wellhead contract admittedly provides for a wellhead sale. It has the common delivery point that you see in these gas purchase agreements, and it's specified to be, you know, right after separator and before the buyer's metering equipment on the lease premises. It says the title.
Why is that clear? Is the contract that clear?
Yes, sir. It's very clear. And I don't know that the clarity of the contract has ever been challenged.
So it's sold at the wellhead to TXO, who then transports it, or who transports it?
It's sold to Delhi, Your Honor. By TXO.
There's something a little unseemly about taking the position that you've got a wholly owned subsidiary, and that alone prevents it from being a sale off premises. I want to really wrestle that.
Well,
point.
Here's what I understand to be the reasoning, and the only way I can find the basis for the reasoning. The court said, and if I can find the point in its opinion, it just said that this was a sham sale, which was entered into by TXO and Delhi for the purpose of depriving these people of their right to
work. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about any other acceptable theory.
I don't know of any other theory I've ever heard advanced. And I have always maintained. If they'd sold directly to SWEPCO, that would have been a sale off the lease premises. So the first sale would have taken place 50 miles away. And it would have been.
But by the use of a subsidiary, wholly owned subsidiary, selling there first and then to SWEPCO, you prevent it from being a sale off the premises.
That's right. That's what the Court of Appeals is reading. I think that's what they have contended. And I say that if some remedies may flow from this transaction, but I do not think it lies in denying the undeniable fact that it's been a sale.
What remedies do flow?
The only other thing I can think of is what they call for breach of the marketing covenant, which the Court of Appeals here really did not grant any primary relief on, but it did grant relief by way of exemplary damages, saying, and I will get to that, that a relationship of trust and confidence exists between the lessee, owing from the lessee to the lessor when it markets production. I say that directly in the teeth of very well-settled opinions from this court, including Amico versus Alexander, the last pronouncement of one of them, where it says the reason but prudent operator standard. There's no fiduciary relationship in that transaction. But it was that so-called breach of fiduciary relationship that they tacked on, or upheld the additional award of $300,000 as attorney's fees. And it was also the use of a fiduciary relationship, which is treated as a tort, and it's not an independent tort at all, not a tort here, it didn't exist, by which they added on another $250,000 in for damages, which were attorney's fees, but which they had not made the statutory demand for.
Let's talk about the actual damages first, if you don't mind. Is there any acceptable theory by which plaintiff royalty owners recovered their actual damages, or the difference between what they were paid and market value in this case?
Not in this case. The only alternative theory I know they've brought is one that they claim that there was a breach of the implied covenant to get a fair and reasonable price for this gas in marketing the production. The facts will deny it totally, and they didn't prove the damages in that way, and the Court of Appeals didn't uphold any damages in that way.
Well, in their claim for fraud, though, don't they have a claim for fraud?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's why they think they're entitled to exemplary damages.
Well, it was until the Court of Appeals knocked out that, and I know you're familiar with this case, Your Honor.
I've written on it once.
Well, they the very thing they held venue on, they've knocked out. And the fact is that they said there is no basis for affirmative misrepresentation of fraud. They said you just told in that division order the fact is based on the fact that said that the terms of the leases would govern in accounting for royalties, and that we weren't accounting for royalties on that basis. That's a misrepresentation. The Court of Appeals, he said, that's not a misstatement. That's the way it's happened. And so they knocked that out, and that has not been brought forward on this appeal. When the Court of Appeals knocked it out, they have not brought to this court in their conditional application any complaint of his ruling in that respect. Now, they also did sue for fraud on non-disclosure. And I don't think the Court of Appeals really dealt with that ground of fraud at all, except that it did in connection with its so-called breach of a confidential relation, say that the reason it was breached was the reason they breached the marketing covenant was because they did not disclose to the lessors the fact of the sale and the fact that Dow High was wholly owned subsidiary. We say it's totally irrelevant to the fact because it's what you do in selling the gas and not what you tell is 200 class plaintiffs here about having to tell them all about it. And so...
Let me get down what the fraud is based on. Tell me exactly what the fraud was.
All right, sir. The fraud is this. They executed, TXO circulated to the plaintiffs division orders to be executed, addressed to TXO. The division orders recite that the royalties to be paid from production from this lease premises, that the leases shall govern as to the royalties to be paid. That's a misrepresentation, they say, because you didn't pay them on that basis. And it's a promissory misrepresentation. It's something you said that would happen in the future, and you didn't do that in the future. And that is the misrepresentational aspect of their fraud count. The non-disclosure aspect of their fraud count is that the division orders provide that the terms of this sale and the sale of gas and all that shall be governed by a gas purchase agreement entered into between TXO, a seller, and Delhi Gas Pipeline Corporation as buyer, and we didn't tell them when we sent the division orders that Delhi was a wholly owned subsidiary of TXO. Those are the two aspects of their fraud.
What is your response?
Our response, first of all, was how could there be any damage? They say they're still recovering all these damages. They executed division order, but what damages did they sustain? I said, secondly, if it's a promissory misrepresentation, we must have had the intention at the time we did all of that to have misled them. We also said what the Court of Appeals did as to the the disclosure one about misrepresentation, that it's true. The leases say what's going to happen, and that's what's true, and there's no misrepresentation.
Why did you set up this arrangement? What does the record show?
The record shows that the gas purchase agreement was entered into on October 15, 1970. That was before Texas Oil and Gas. It's between Texas Oil and Gas and Delhi now. Before they owned any of these leases. Before any of the wells had been drilled and completed. It's even before some of the leases had been executed, which created these royalties. It's a common provision for a wellhead sale of gas, and there's lots of gas bought and sold at wellhead in this country. And all we did then, after having that arrangement, is Delhi had its end market with ITC and SWEPCO, to which it's committed, It went along, picked up gas. We drilled these wells, it took this gas and delivered it to them. And there's no misrepresentation. The royalty clauses are common. There's combination proceeds and market value clause like we had in the Middleton case. And the wellhead gas purchase contract is very common. There's nothing outside of standard practices that have been used here. And
you just apply the standing arrangement that you already had.
That's what we did.
It wasn't set up just for this?
No, sir. And I think that is a source of a basic misapprehension. And the Court of Appeal opinion said that we didn't enter into this contract until we put the wells online. Well, that was 2.5 years later. We had this contract in 1960.
Did the jury have the benefit of what you're telling us now?
How's that, Your Honor?
Did the jury have the benefit of the arguments you're making to us?
It was non-jury.
Did the judge, I'm sorry, have the benefit?
Yes, he did. We filed trial.
He ruled against you, didn't he?
I was not very successful before this judge. And he knew his trial law, and I can't knock him for anything but the result. And but he did, and it was argued and briefed extensively before him. The basis, I said, of the Court of Appeal's opinion just was his statement. It's on the first page of the opinion. I believe that's the source, maybe, of its misapprehension and why it held as it did.
Were the charges that were made by subsidiary Delahaye's normal charges?
Yes, sir. And I might say that Delahaye's charges were the same throughout the course of this litigation. They were 13.5 cents an MCF for hauling half the gas. This is prorated basis. This gas is in mixed stream with a lot of gases. For hauling it 50 miles. And it were 15 cents an MCF for hauling an additional 50, or a total of 100 miles. Very modest charges. And Delahaye never received anything except that price spread. This is not a deal where selling it to Delahaye, Delahaye had the right to go run with this gas and get whatever the market would bring. It was already committed on resale contracts to IPC and SWEPCO. That's the whole basis. Those markets are the basis that this 190 miles of pipeline throughout East Texas were built on.
Was there evidence of what any other pipeline would charge, actual evidence in the record that Delahaye's charges were commensurate with any other pipeline in business?
You mean the price it paid for gas?
Well,
charges, no other evidence about charges I saw, Your Honor. They were asked about who else would have bought this gas at a higher price. And the only evidence in the record is that no price is higher or higher had ever been paid for this gas in this area. Matter of fact, there was no market for sour gas at that time until Delahaye built this pipeline across the Smacco Old Trend of East Texas. And they paid the highest price it had been. And at the time the contract was entered into, that was the same. At the time they amended it before first delivery in 72, that was still the same. 25 cents an MMBTU. Now they're going to tell you they got 1 cent an MCF. But what they do is they're overlooking the fact that at this time and long before, when energy became valuable, we quit selling it in volume. We sold it by MMBTUs. This gas has 535 to 600. It's one of the lowest BTU gases you've ever heard of. But it was enough. It was not enough to satisfy the requirements of SWEPCO and IPC. But you could mix it with higher BTU gas and it would achieve that level of 7 to 750, which would make it usable as boiler fuel.
Now, did Delahaye process it and get some of that sulfur out?
Yes, sir. And they got the proceeds of the sulfur, which don't nearly, under this record, correspond with the cost of getting that sulfur out.
Who sweetened it now? I thought CXO.
No, sir. It's Delahaye. Okay. Under agreements entered into by Delahaye. And Delahaye kept the proceeds of the sulfur, did not account to anybody else for it. Any of the other working interest on the site.
And there's no evidence anywhere in the record of an excessive charge for the extraction of the sulfur or the transmission of the gas for whatever distance, 1,500 miles.
I don't know of any complaint about an excessive charge. I do know that when the gas was paid for, and this is a common procedure also, that they were allowed, that Delahaye was allowed to deduct 5.5 cents per MCF as because it was sour gas. But that was actually passed through a 5.5 cent fee on up the line that Delahaye had plus other charges, and they just didn't pass them all through. It was sour gas, frequently in gas purchase agreements, this one, allowance is made. Now, I call it an allowance because it doesn't really cover all the charges. An allowance is made under quality specification for certain deductions. And 5.5 cents per MCF charge was allowed there. The Dell had deducted from what was paid to all the working interest owners. But as far as excessiveness, no, sir.
Now, what did Judge Cornelius say in his opinion was the ground for holding that Delhi was the alter ego of TXO or vice versa?
In his opinion, the court stated, Delhi was merely the alter ego of its parent, TXO, and the district court could disregard the purported sale at the well and find that the true sale was off-premises at the SWEPCO and IPC plants. And they said somewhere in there that it was because Delhi entered into this contract with TXO for the purpose that this was a sham for the purpose of depriving the plaintiffs of their rightful royalties.
He gave no factual basis for his finding?
Not other than what I see there. And the only one I can see possibly would be the fact that if it had not contained the wellhead sale provisions, they would have received more. But the contract was entered into and set up and whole thing long prior to any of the actual sale or first delivery of gas. Now, on alter ego, this court's written on it many times, and quoting very briefly from one of the more recent cases, in Lucas v. Texas Industries, it says the court will not disregard the carpet fiction except in exceptional circumstances. I believe the court knows what they are here, and the principal reason above all others is there's been that you don't disregard the carpet fiction here is because this inter-carpet relationship simply has not been used to harm or create an inequitable result to these plaintiffs in any way. We say that if anything, the reverse is true because what has been granted these people, and what they've been granted, not just on what Delhi receives up in the line, they've been granted a market value, and this is the market value of it, we say too, is just not there. It just is incompetent for the basis, and we showed the basis, but the thing about it is if you add, you take the amount of that judgment, and you take what they've already been paid and add all the service tax payable for their benefit, they're getting, for this royalty gas itself, $850,000 more than Delhi gets this gas when it resells it to IPC and SWEPCO. If anything, there's the reverse of an inequity in the situation. Five of these leases do not even have this so-called combination market value and proceeds. They just say that if the gas is sold, then we will account to you for 1/8 of the amount realized in the sale. There's no market value in it. None of those, there's no question. You don't have to pierce carpet veil anything. You just don't get any more than that. That also was not mentioned by the Court of Appeal in its opinion. We did bring forward on this appeal. The points upon which this application for writ of error were granted, and it's, I think it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 8, 9, and 10. They really deal with four subjects. That's one of them. The second one is the duty and the measure of the duty of the lease operator in marketing gas production from the lease premises.
Before you leave, alter ego, do you intend to discuss Castleberry versus Branscombe?
Yes, sir. In that case, the court, and I think my position harmonizes with whether I'm with the five or the four. Not all nine are here, but
I still almost 3 years.
Yeah. I would think it is. I've been watching. In that case, though, that was just a case. I said just a case. It was a case where the two individual shareholders who were majority shareholders of the three in a closed corporation were held liable for corporate debt. And they went there and literally ran the other guy out of the business, as I recall. And I believe they called it a moving business, and they created a situation where they siphoned off the assets of the thing. They'd given them a note, corporate note only, for that, and they rendered the value of the assets of the corporation meaningless. And he sued on the note and recovered, of course, on the theory of alter ego from the other two. There was a charge there which was not properly objected to, which enabled the plaintiff to make some of this recovery. But had the charge been properly objected to or anything else, I don't see anything about that decision hurting here. It does say constructive fraud can be the basis. I believe that had already been held anyway without people admitting it.
Many times.
And so I see nothing in that case which really affects this one. But if I said that I hadn't been watching the case very closely, then I'd be misrepresenting the facts.
Okay. Go ahead, the other point.
All right, sir. The other points are that, as I said, the second one had to do, and I've asked Mr. York to argue this because I know he'll do a better job than I can.
You want to turn him loose now or later?
As soon as I see...
The red light?
how many minutes is that, 20? I'm sorry.
You have 5 minutes left of your original 30 minutes.
Oh, I'm already going 25. All right, then. I wanted to give Mr. York 10 minutes, and, yeah, but I...
You'll have some more time.
All right, sir. All right. The other points were, and that one was breach of the marketing covenant. That was the second group. The third thing was exemplary damages. I would ask him to argue that. And the fourth was division orders, and I wanted to argue that one now. And then 5 minutes, I'd like to speak about division orders. In this case, there is a trial stipulation, and it recites that most of the plaintiffs executed and returned division orders. Now, these division orders contain provisions to the effect that it is agreed that the purchase and sale of gas shall be covered, subject to, and controlled by that certain gas purchase contract between Delhi Gas Pipeline Corporation as buyer and Texas Oil and Gas Corporation as seller, dated October 15, 1970, including any supplements and amendments. Now, that's the basis upon which we have counted these people for their gas all along, right up through now, or through the time of trial in any event. And they continue to do so. We think these division orders constitute a precise and definite basis for payments of royalties, and the payments as accepted by them are now preclude them from further recovery. And this is in line with the court's opinion in Exxon versus Middleton, where it held that any division order like this does hold them, does buy them until it's revoked. Now, I'm aware of this court's subsequent opinion in Govinda versus Strait of Energy, but it does not violate anything I here stand for. Because that case also recognized it, now there was an erroneous calculation of royalties in that case. And the producer had sent out the division order, had profited. There was some unjust enrichment as a result of it. And for that reason, it was held that they were not binding there. But the court went to great pains in that case to point out that the facts in Middleton were different, just as they are here, because in Middleton, the producer had paid out just the amount it realized from the sale of gas, just like we had here. And they were trying to hold them for even more than that. And it was held in that case, which recognizes the present one, that they are precluded here. Now, they may claim that they revoked these division orders, but if they make the claim, it's pretty hard to do because they sued on these division orders and affirmed their existence through the holding of the Court of Appeals. And so I think that would say that they didn't do it there, but aside from that, revocation is a ground of defense to our claim of the execution of division orders. And there are many, many findings by the trial court in conclusions of law, but revocation is not one of them. And Rule 299 would say that that is not a ground of affirmance on appeal. If they would try to do it, though I don't think it's necessary to reach that point. That concludes my argument for that phase of it. If I may, unless there are further questions, I'll now yield to Mr. York on the other points you're talking about.
May it please the court, Mr. Barron and I had hoped to work it so that I would have 10 minutes if I could go. I won't go any longer than that if the court would grant us that much, or go less if the court would prefer.
We're going to give you an extra 15 minutes like we did the other side, Mr. York. You can either use it now or you can save it for
yes,
later,
sir.
Whichever way.
That's fine. That's
all the time. Either side will be extended.
All right, sir. As Mr. Barron said, my remarks will be limited to points 3, 8, and 9, which are the ones which deal with what the standard of care is for an operator and the applicability of exemplary damages to a breach of one of these covenants. I will not be addressing the question of whether or not the marketing covenant was breached. That's very hotly contested, and Mr. Barron will continue to discuss that in detail with you. The points that I would like to discuss are basically the same ones that we made in our firm's amicus brief, which we filed before we were actually involved in the case, and many of them are the same that the Amoco Production Company made in its excellent amicus brief, which is on file with the court. The one of the principal reasons why this case has caused concern in the industry and around the state is that it is a straying from the very clear rule that this court announced in Amoco versus Alexander by Judge Campbell in 1981, defining what the standard of care or standard of conduct for a operator is. This court has clearly said that the standard is that he shall do what a reasonably prudent operator would do under the same or similar circumstances. The Alexander Court, Judge Campbell, went further to say that the breach of that covenant is a wrong sounding in contract and not in tort. He affirmatively found that in the case. The Alexander case, as the court will recall, was a drainage case, but it was a breach of one of the other implied covenants, the one in this case being a marketing covenant. This case, the Court of Appeals somehow, I suppose, overlooked Amoco versus Alexander. Amoco versus Alexander is not cited in the Court of Appeals case, either on the proposition that you can't give exemplary damages for breach of contract, or on the proposition that you can't, that the standard of conduct for the operator is reasonably prudent operator. The Court of Appeals said that the standard was something on the order of one of highest good faith or best of good faith, and they have the effect of treating, although I don't believe they use the word fiduciary, they treat the lessee as a fiduciary. But the lessee, the operator, it's not a confidential relationship. He can buy and sell that interest without the permission of the lessor. Unlike what you could do in a normal partnership or joint venture, you couldn't just sell to somebody else without your partner's permission in a confidential relationship. The lessee and the lessor are at times in a conflicting role or in conflicting positions, because the lessee has the sole power to develop the lease at his cost, and his ideas of how it ought to be done may differ from those of the lessor. It's not a fiduciary relationship. The lessee simply has to do what a reasonably prudent operator would do under the same circumstances. And what we would hope the court would do here today is to clearly reaffirm the court stand in the 1981 case of Alexander versus Amoco. The Court of Appeals seemed to, once it had adopted the wrong standard for the conduct of the operator, seemed then to leap to the idea that the breach of that standard was a tort. When they began to talk about good faith, it seemed to me to treat that as if it were a tort. If you were not in good faith, then you committed some kind of a wrong which was a tort and would give rise to exemplary damages. The cases are well settled, though, in the Amoco versus Alexander, only one in a long line, to the effect that the duty to develop, the duty to prevent drainage, and the duty to market are contractual covenants. They're implied covenants that become part of the contract. This court has never, to my knowledge, varied from that. The Pyote case, Amoco versus Pyote, mentioned in the Court of Appeals opinion, has some sort of vague language about good faith, but when this court NRE'd that opinion in its per curiam NRE, the court seemed to me carefully avoided saying anything about good faith and just said we find some evidence that the marketing covenant had been violated. Mangus versus Guerra was a different kind of case. As the court will recall, that was a person with the executive rights being held to have a fiduciary duty to his co-tenant. But that is totally separate and distinct from what we have here with a lessee. It seemed to us, that what the Court of Appeals did was get confused on some of the older cases, like they cited one called Etter versus Sternberg. or Von Sternberg, where the court used some of the old language that was sometimes used before this court wrote Belafonte and before the Alexander case came down, where they said you might get exemplary damages for a breach of a contract if it was accompanied by a malicious and oppressive act, something of that sort. Simply accompanied by, just somehow meanly breached the contract or did it maliciously, you might get exemplary damages. This court in Belafonte, which was decided, of course, this year, and in Amico versus Alexander, clearly says that you cannot get damages, exemplary damages, for breach of a contract, no matter how maliciously or meanly or mischievously it's done. There are some cases which give rise to perhaps a tort at the same time as a contract. You might have a lawyer with a client. He has a contract with his client. He may violate that contract. That violation may also be a tort. It may be a malpractice case. And there are two or three cases that set up examples of that sort, where there can be a duty which arises outside the contract, as it was in Mangus versus Guerra, until you have a breach of contract and a tort. I think really what the cases are saying in those circumstances is that we are not going to allow the fact that there was a contract cause of action to be used as a shield to protect someone when a tort cause of action is brought against them. In sum, we would just say that the implied covenant under Alexander creates a duty to act as a reasonably prudent operator, that there was no tort committed here, that no matter what you call it, you can't make it a tort by calling it a tort, that this was, at worst, a breach of the malicious, a breach of the implied covenant to market. And whether it was malicious or mean or ugly or whatever else it was, according to the other side, it was only a breach of contract.
Now that's fraud.
Well, there were two sides of fraud. First was the fraud in the, which Mr. Barron briefly alluded to, in the signing of the division order. The Court of Appeals found that there's no evidence to support that, and that has not been brought up to this court. The court also made some rather vague, to me, references to fraud in connection with this sale, fraud and failing to tell about the subsidiary relationship and so on. It's our position, and I believe it's accurate, that even if you call that fraud, it's not fraud. That it is simply a breach of the contract. That at worst, it is a breach of the marketing covenant. And if you do it in a mean way or an ugly way or however you do it, that's all it is. That it can't be fraud. That there's not any duty there other than the duty imposed by the contract and the implied covenant that goes with the contract. And that therefore, as a matter of law, there couldn't be any fraud in that circumstance.
So there's no duty to tell the royalty owners that you're going to be self-dealing.
I don't think so. I think if you do that and it's found that there's some damage, self-dealing wouldn't make any difference if you got the price. In other words, if the price hadn't been a problem, or somebody hadn't thought price was a problem, or there was a differential, nobody, I don't think, would care about self-dealing. So the real, if there's a breach of the implied covenant, the breach would be in failing to get the price that a reasonably prudent operator would have gotten. And self-dealing, it seems to me, is just a part of that. It's just one of the many circumstances you look at to see what a reasonably prudent operator would do in these circumstances.
So as long as they got the correct price, even if there had been self-dealing, you said there'd be no fraud.
Yes, sir. I don't think I just don't believe that there'd be. I think anything that happened here is just a breach of the contract at the worst. As Judge Campbell said in Alexander, it sounds in contract and not in tort. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Responder. Yeah, that's
right.
May it please the court, I'm David Lake from Tyler, Texas, and sitting at the counsel's table is Jess Nickerson from Pittsburgh, Texas. We represent the respondents in this case. If there's ever been a case before this court where piercing the corporate veil is appropriate, this is a case. Mr. Barron did not go into a lot of the facts, and I'd like to refresh the court's memory about these. Of course, the plaintiffs in this case consist of some 250 plus royalty owners. in Camp County. They hold their interest under leases that were pooled, or parts of which were pooled, comprising three units, each of which have one well. Of course, the well is a smackover well. It's deep, sour gas, low BTU. There was testimony by TXO's expert that sour gas is very dangerous, very deadly, and it cannot be marketed, cannot be sold without treating. He said the normal procedure and practice is for the gas to be taken to a treating plant, and they're treated with the hydrogen sulfide knocked out, and then the gas is sold. In fact, of the fields that he had studied there in preparation of his testimony, and all of those fields where sour gas was being produced, this was what was being done. In fact, when I took his deposition, he testified, it was his opinion, that this gas from the Pittsburgh field was being sold after it was being treated at Getty. Now, the gas is being taken 7.5 miles away from the field and being treated at a plant that was built and paid for by Texas Oil and Gas. Texas Oil and Gas entered into the contract, and Texas Oil and Gas paid for that expense, as well as for the expense of the gas gathering lines and the transmission lines. In fact, they paid all of Delhi's expenses. Now, it was stipulated that these expenses were charged back to Delhi on intercompany books. But the uncontradicted testimony, uncontroverted testimony in this case, is that Texas Oil and Gas has always paid all of Delhi's expenses. The Texas Oil and Gas arranged to sell with Delhi at the well 2.5 years before this gas was ever produced, before the wells were completed. And this was during a period of time when gas prices were going up daily. The six-day war occurred in 1967, and shortly thereafter, everybody was scurrying about trying to find gas and energy. And in the early 70s, the producers were trying to find reservoirs. And Texas Oil and Gas arranged to sell with Delhi before, two and a half years before, the wells were put online. In fact, it was 2.5 years before they even contracted for the necessary treating facility. The treating plant was necessary for this gas. Now, when they contracted for that gas, they knew at the time what they were going after. Because if you look in the contract, it specified sour gas. It specified smackover gas. And Mr. Wayne Miller, the geologist for Texas Oil and Gas, testified that all smackover gas is sour gas and has to be treated. And Texas Oil and Gas contracted to sell all of its smackover gas in Pittsburgh, in Camp County, in Pittsburgh Field, that it owned at that time or would acquire later. And so Texas Oil and Gas knew long before they completed the wells what they were doing. Now, as far as the price was 25 cents per MMBTU. And they arranged for the royalty owners to be charged 5.5 cents per MCF for treating this gas 7.5 miles away at a plant that TXO built and paid for, which was unusual. You know, why would a producer, an operator, go out here and build a plant and then turn around and charge itself 5.5 cents, you know, for treating the gas there at the plant? But after you take out the 5.5 cents and adjust the gas for the BTU, because it was low BTU, the royalty owners got a little over 1 cent per MCF for their royalty. In fact, they were getting this same amount for a long time after this lawsuit was filed. The wells went on production in 1973, March of 73. This suit was filed in the spring of 75. There's been a lot of correspondence back and forth. It's in the record between the royalty owners and Texas Oil and Gas and trying to get them to rectify the situation, and they refused to do anything. In fact, the gas price was never increased until 1976, September, I believe it's September or March of 76, it was raised to 45 cents. Now, in the meantime, Texas Oil and Gas through Delhi stepped out there, and they bought some gas from Corpus Christi leaseholds from an adjoining field in June of 73 for twice the price of what they were paying the royalty owners. And that's in the record. In that contract, they allowed for the gas to be redetermined every 2 years, the price of the gas. And the sellers, they weren't going to give up their rights to the sulfur. And that's something else that the treating plants say. When you take out the hydrogen sulfide, the result of that process is the sulfur that's being produced. And since the cell was not at the wellhead, Texas Oil and Gas could keep that sulfur through Delhi and not have to pay any royalties on it. So, and that was contrary to practice, because Corpus Christi leaseholds, what did they do? When they sold the gas, they retained their rights to the sulfur production.
Mr. Lake, was there, I believe I heard Mr. Barron say there was no market for the sour gas prior to TXO or Delhi building the treatment plant in that area, is that?
That's not correct, Your Honor. The testimony was from even from Mr. Key, their expert witness, that there were 17 treating facilities in the East Texas area. And that some of these, in fact, there could have been more, and some of these plants went out of business because they didn't have sour gas to treat. And some of them were further away, some were close by, but there was no reason other than transportation, and our witness testified that that was not a problem then, because the buyers were wanting the gas so bad that they would have built the lines out there to have gotten the gas.
But, at the time, these leases were entered into or later?
No, back in early 70s, and back in the 60s, up at the Brian Mills field, that gas is dated back in the early 60s. And that's sour gas, and they wanted sour gas. And Mr. Sims, our expert witness, testified that in January of 73, which was before this gas went online, the price of that gas was 31 cents, which was higher than what, you know, and that was old gas because that contract dated back in the early 60s. He identified at least three purchasers who would have been willing to purchase that gas. But what we have here is that there was nobody else out there, see, because Texas Oil and Gas in Delhi locked it or tried to lock this gas in 2.5 years before the wells were completed by contract. See.
And what did they pay for gas if they had to buy it later? Or that they either, I don't know what they had to buy, but they did in fact buy from other sellers. What did they pay for that gas?
Texas Oil and Gas through Delhi, and I'll get to that in a minute, paid 45 cents per MMBTU at the same time on an adjoining field of the same type of gas, low BTU, around 550 BTU, sour, extremely sour gas. They paid about twice what they were paying for this gas right here. Plus, in that contract, they allowed those sellers, redetermination provisions so that they could redetermine their price of gas after
every
2 years.
Did they run that gas through the Delhi treatment?
Went right through the same plant, went right on down the transmission line to SWEPCO and IPC, who were the ultimate consumers of that gas. Now there was other gas from other nearby fields. There was the New Hope field, and both experts testified that in January of 74 that gas was selling for over $1, and it went on up, and that was almost identical, smack over sour gas, and that was during the time that the plant's gas was getting 25 cents per MMBTU.
Does price differential alone make a case for you?
That's part of the case, Your Honor. But let me get
a lot of price differential out there today by contract.
Well, there was back then. Of course, the climate today is different.
That they tried to lock this in, and I guess what I'm just asking is, can you just lock it in if you do it legally and properly?
Well, of course, I think that gets into the Amoco versus First Baptist Church Pyote case and the duty of marketing the gas in good faith, and whether or not you have satisfied that duty by going into a contract under those terms. You know, I'd say that producers today are shying away from long-term contracts without there being redetermination provisions in there, and that's what they're trying to do, is to be sure that they're meeting that duty to market in good faith. I'd like to get into some of the facts about Delhi, because,
we're very interested in all of the facts that either side wants to argue that you think is a strong support of your position as distinguished from law. We want to hear some law, too, but we want to be awfully sure that we understand all the facts of the case that either of you think supports your position.
Mr. Barron got into something about the leases. All except five leases in this case provide that on gas that is sold off the premises, the royalty to be paid is based on market value. They're real clear about that. And if it's sold at the well, the royalty is based upon the amount realized from the sale. We believe that by trying to take this situation where sour gas is not normally sold at the well, you know, and pinpointing the point of sale right there, they were attempting to lock the royalty owners in, not only to low contract prices, but also getting away from having to pay market value royalties, and also trying to take the sulfur without having to pay the royalties on the sulfur. And the fact that they did this long before they ever contracted for the treating facility, you know, shows, you know, what their intent was. But
was that fraud? Is that your contention? That was fraud to try to lock in the price before they even maybe drill some of the well.
That's part of it, Your Honor. There's also testimony of Mr. Young, their general counsel, which I think indicates what they were trying to do too, when he said the division orders were sent out to try to modify or amend the terms of the leases. And I'll get to that later, but normally the situation would have been then, by selling this sour gas off premises, what would have happened? Well, the royalty owners would have been paid royalties based upon market value. Plus, they would have been paid royalties based upon the sulfur that was being produced. When the royalty owners started investigating to see what was happening, and of course when they sent out the division orders, they didn't know who Delhi was. You know, there was nothing in that division order to tell them that Delhi was their wholly owned subsidiary. So they, most of them signed them, or a lot of them did, send the stipulation there and send them back. And then after they start getting their royalties, because they've got to get their royalties, you know, and you have to sign that division order to get the royalties, they won't pay you unless you do otherwise. Then they started saying, you know, my royalty's only a penny.
Was there any evidence from anybody about the part of the division order that said that they'd be paid based upon contract between Texas Oil and Gas and Delhi? With any facts that
no.
Somebody said I didn't know or tried to offer some parole evidence or anything anybody told them?
Your Honor, the division order doesn't say that they'll be paid based upon, it makes reference to that sale. The division order in this case is not like the division order that was in the Middleton case.
Have you got it handy so you can show us exactly how it read?
Under the sixth provision.
Don't take your time on the argument, but at some point.
I'll have it ready, Your Honor.
Exactly the language in the division order.
But it says something like this: the sale of this gas is covered by that certain sales agreement between Texas Oil and Gas and Delhi, dated October 15, 1970, and as amended. And that's it. There's nothing in there where by signing that division order, the royalty owners committed themselves to be bound to be paid by the terms of that, royalties based upon the terms of that sale. There's nothing in that division order. Only thing in that division order that binds the royalty owners was about their interest. They warranted the title that they owned and about the interest that was shown. That's why we say this division order is very similar to the one in the, I think it was the Butler case cited in our brief there. But anyway, after the royalty owners started investigating the matter, they found out, you know, look, Delhi is TXO's gas department. Since the very inception of Delhi, all of its officers, directors, were all officers and directors of TXO. In fact, they considered themselves the employees of TXO and were paid by TXO. In fact, Delhi didn't have any employees. They were all TXO employees. And when I took Mr. Ellis's deposition, he let it slip, and he even referred to Delhi as their gas department. You know, he said the people who are handling the Delhi accounts and doing that work is our gas department. That was what he said.
The language in Judge Ray's handed it to me. The purchase and sale of gas should be controlled by that certain gas purchase contract between Delhi and Texas oil and gas. You're suggesting that that doesn't cover price?
There's nothing in there that indicates the price or that the gas was sold off premises or where, or that the royalty owners would be paid royalties based upon any pricing division in that contract.
Does the term of such leases shall govern as to the price to be paid? Do you think that's relevant?
Yes, sir. We say that the division order, and the Court of Appeals pointed this out, is that in the very first provision, it says that the prices to be paid will be controlled by the leases. And the royalty owners naturally thought, well, this gas is being sold off premises, and therefore the price that I'd be paid would be market value price on my royalty.
Counsel, let's assume for the sake of argument that the court would agree with you that this is a situation where alter ego, you know, we pierce the corporate veil, Delhi and TX are one and the same. What flows from that? Are you going to get into the argument that this is not a tort, that it entitles you to punitive damages, that this is a breach of warranty?
Well, you know, there were several theories of recovery, but it definitely is a tort. It's constructive fraud, and this is what I think the court classified this in the Castleberry versus Braxton case, and I failed to cite that in my brief, but the court's well aware of the case, and in that case, it listed six instances in which the courts are justified in piercing the corporate veil, and I suggested to this court that we fall under four of those instances. The alter ego, and there are other things I didn't get a chance to talk about Delhi and Texas Oil and Gas, but the alter ego, the corporate fiction was used to defraud the plaintiffs of their rightful royalties, to justify a wrong, and to evade a legal obligation under the leases. Let me go back to Delhi just a second, because there's so many things about Delhi that I think the court needs to be aware of. Testimony was that Delhi had no offices, but their offices were the offices of Texas Oil and Gas. And then there was evidence that in public statements, SEC statements and so forth, that they were referred to as one and the same company. And then that TXO and Delhi had mortgaged all or some of their property together, jointly. That they had filed consolidated tax returns. And as I said a while ago, that TXO paid all of Delhi's expenses. Now there were some things that I mentioned that shows where these companies disregarded standard corporate formalities, not only here but also in the building of the treating plant. You know, Texas Oil and Gas was the producer. Now why would they go out here and spend that money and add on to that treating plant like they did and contract for it themselves? It wasn't Delhi's contract. And then turn around and put the point of sale at the wellhead. Well, there's only one reason. And we've gone through that. And the other thing that showed that they defied the standard corporate procedures is that in doing this, the companies, as most companies do, used AFEs, Authorities for Expenditures, but in their case, it was one authority for expenditure. Delhi didn't have theirs, you know, and it was approved by the officers of the company, and they went out and spent the money. And Texas Oil and Gas have theirs. It's just one, you know. So there's a lot of evidence in this case which shows that these companies were one company, and all they'd do is pick up the hat over here and had Delhi on it. They'd put it on, and one hat over here said Texas Oil and Gas. When it came time to take this one off, they sit over here and pick up this one, put it on. And this was the type of factual situation that this course is faced with.
On that point, is the only thing before us a no evidence point, or are there others?
Yes, sir. I believe that is the question for this court. That is there evidence to support the trial court's finding? And this is a question of fact. This court addressed that in the Castleberry case, says it's a question of fact. Also in State versus Swift and Company, the court there says the question of fact, and the trial court found that and held that they were one and the same company, and TXO had used this arrangement to deprive the plaintiffs of their royalties.
And that's the key point, not whether or not they change in halves. We know that that's allowable under corporate structure. Whether it's carried out for some illegal or improper purpose. And all the reasons that were stated in the majority opinion of Branscombe. So, I want to be sure I've heard everything you have to say that you think brings you within a fact issue of constructive fraud or using the corporation as a sham, using it to defraud someone. Because that, it seems to me, is what is at issue.
Wouldn't the fact be that they were selling gas which ordinarily was not sold at the well, and this arrangement was used to do that, be a very important fact for this court to consider?
Perhaps so. What else you got?
Plus the fact that the terms that they tried to sell the gas were much less than what they were willing to do on identical gas from a nearby field at the same time. That was the Corpus Christi leaseholds field. And in that contract, they allowed the sellers to retain royalties on the sulfur. Plus the fact that Mr. Young, when he testified, he's the general counsel for Texas Oil and Gas, about the division orders. It was his testimony that the division orders were sent out to in an attempt to alter or amend the leases. And what he had in mind is by inference, but he thought that the obligation for this type of gas normally would have been to account to the royalty owners on market value. They didn't do that. So to cover themselves, they'll get this division order signed, which refers to the sale. Now what he overlooked was in the very first provision there, the division orders do state that the terms in the leases would govern as to the prices to be paid for the gas. And the provision 6 there in the division order did not really speak to the pricing of the gas.
Counsel, since this court has come out with Lucas and Castleberry within a very short space of time, can you offer any distinctions between this case and the Lucas case? I know you would like Castleberry to control.
Yes, sir. I'm think
suggesting why doesn't Lucas apply?
I think there's one major distinction. As I recall, of course, Lucas was a tort case, and there the court was concerned with the financial integrity or ability of the subsidiary, and that issue was not really proven, as I recall, that case. But there, the court talked about the contractual relationship between the parties under a contract arrangement. It's a little bit more difficult to pierce the corporate veil because the parties should be able to contract and protect themselves. In this situation, on these leases, there's no way under the sun these people could have contracted and foreseen someone coming in under an assignment. And that's what Texas Oil and Gas had under the majority of these leases was an assignment and then doing what they did. So that part doesn't hold true in Lucas. Plus, I feel, as far as evidence, that we've shown a lot more evidence here and facts and circumstances for piercing the corporate veil, that the arrangement was made and was used to deprive the plaintiffs because the sale of the sour gas was, or attempted to be at the sale, at the well, and normally it's not at the well.
What is your best fallback position?
Well, of course, it's breach of the implied duty to market in good faith. And along that line...
Can you win on that without piercing the corporate veil?
Yes, sir. It depends on what this court says about the duty, whether that duty involves a confidential relationship or not. I'd like to argue about that in a few minutes. Before I forget one thing, Mr. Barron said that there was no evidence in the record or any other theory in which the sale could have been held off premises. And there is some evidence there. It comes from their expert witness that I mentioned a while ago. And place of sale, I think, in Exxon, in the Exxon versus Milton case was, or maybe it was the Butler case was said to be a question of fact. And Mr. Key did testify that it was his understanding. Now, he did say this was his understanding. Of course, he was an expert witness, that this sale was off-premises. And I think that does provide some basis, it did in the Butler case, for finding an off-premise sale. I've cited some cases in my brief there about the piercing the corporate veil, and I think the Court of Appeals did announce the correct law, the law that this court has held in this case. I'd like to turn the court's attention now to the duty to market. I think that issue was raised in points 3 and 4 of TXO's application. The court below observed that TXO owed the plaintiffs the duty to market the gas in the best of good faith to obtain the best price reasonably obtainable. This duty placed TXO in a position of trust and confidence to plaintiffs, which TXO violated by failing to disclose its relationship with Delhi and pertinent facts concerning the sale, and in arranging a sham sale to deprive plaintiffs of their rightful royalties.
Is that a tort?
I think that would be a tort. It would also be a breach of that duty. But I think this is what the Court of Appeals held, too, and as far as awarding exemplary damages, was that a tort had been committed.
I'm trying to pin the tort down. That's the problem I'm having in this case. What is the tort? Is it this breach of duty that constitutes a fraud? I want you to tell us what the tort is, Mr. Chairman.
Well, the tort would be the constructive fraud that this case held in Castleberry versus Branscombe. And we're saying that in breaching the duty, they also committed the tort. They could have sold the gas to a third party out there, and you may have had the situation where it was just a breach of that duty. But they chose not to do that. And so because they did it that way, there is a tort involved, and we believe that the exemplary damages are appropriate in this case.
How would you compare this with Amoco versus Alexander as far as the tort is concerned? Amoco just flatly refused to drill an offset well and allowed the premises to be drained. Here, these people sold gas at a lesser price, both in contravention of contract. How, compare those with Will you and explain to us how one would be a tort and another wouldn't?
Well, it's just what I said. In this case, they chose not to deal with the third party, but with themselves. And so in arranging the sale with themselves, there's constructive fraud upon the plaintiffs, upon the royalty owners.
How wouldn't it be the same thing in Alexander?
That involved the drainage obligation, as I recall. And
they just chose not to spend the money.
They chose not to spend the money. But here they're also using this third party to put a sale at the well, which shouldn't be at the well. And it's depriving the plaintiffs from sulfur royalties, as well as royalties based upon market value.
Does Mangus against Gura apply in this situation?
Well, I was coming to that. The court below cited Amoco Production versus First Baptist Church of Pyote. And although that fact situation is different, there's language in that case citing Justice Spears' concurring opinion in English versus Fisher, supporting the premise that a confidential or fiduciary relationship or duty arises not from the contract but from the relationship of the parties. And we think that this is correct observation of that case. In fact, Justice Spears in that opinion cites the areas of law where this has been applied, insurance and so forth, and comes down to oil and gas and cites, see also, Amoco Production versus First Baptist Church of Pyote, the coveting duty. Now, he says, (clears He talks about this special relationship, and he says that this special relationship has developed because there's been trust, or confidence, of course, placed upon that party, the lessee. And that's what you have in this situation. And that is when the lessor signs that lease, he places the confidence and trust in the lessee that he'll go out there and he'll use good faith in getting the best price, the best terms of possible for his production. Why does he do that? Because he thinks the lessor has the same interest that he has. And that is, the lessor wants to do that. He wants to serve his own interest that way. And in doing that, he's going to serve the lessee wants to do that. And in doing that, he'll serve the lessor's purpose as well.
Councilman, is that a departure from the task of the regional food operator? Are we overly complicating matters by having a couple of good faith and fair dealing here with Metro and lessee in oil and gas situations?
Well, I think there's a departure also in the pooling provision, because I believe in the Expando case that the court has held, and the same type of confidence is reposed in the lessee there, that the duty is a fiduciary duty. And in those circumstances, there is confidence placed upon the lessee. Now, going back to the reasonably prudent operator test, I think that test was first applied in the coal production case. And in that case, there was a delay from the time that the production was found until the time that it was marketed. And the question was whether or not the operator had been reasonably prudent in trying to market the production. And that's a different type of circumstances where you're challenging the good faith, particularly where the lessee's interest does not coincide with the lessor's. I think that this court would be justified in holding that under those circumstances, and I think that's the Lacuno language, where the lessee does not have the incentive to market the gas in good faith, then the court or the law will hold them to a higher standard, a more strict standard. Where they're selling to themselves, then the duty ought to be one of utmost good faith. And this is what the Court of Appeals states. I think that's what the Court of Appeals in the Amoco Production Company versus First Baptist Church of Pahoa also was stating.
I think that's what the court said in the 90s,
too. What case were you citing?
The last case was the Amoco Production Company versus First Baptist Church of Pahoa, Court of Appeals.
I thought you cited a later case in your discussion. I thought I heard you say Lacuno or something.
Like that. Oh, Lacuno versus Smith, which is cited in our brief, Your Honor. There, the producer, by the terms of the division order, was allowed to contract with himself in selling the gas. And the Court of Appeals held him to a more strict duty. It was he had to contract or market the gas in utmost good faith. And that was a NRE case.
You say all three of those cases stand for the proposition that if you deal with yourself, then you owe that duty to the other party.
You owe a higher duty to the lessor. And I submit that should be the law. As well, I submit that the lessor is placing confidence in the lessee to go out and market the gas in good faith, that there is a confidential relationship there. He's putting trust in it. He thinks that his interest, the lessee's interest, are the same as his, as his. And
what's arm's length between the two parties then would be at the price arrived at? But in all other respects, their interests are identical, of the lessee and the lessor in obtaining the best price. Or is that a fair statement?
Well, I would say that the duty would be in good faith at arm's length. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I suppose.
I'd like to go to points 8 and 9, where TXO has claimed the appeals court erred in affirming the trial court's award of exemplary damages and attorney fees as part of exemplary damages. And I've already mentioned the Mangus versus Guerrero case, where the court held that breach of this fiduciary duty should also include exemplary damages where actual damages are shown. We believe that we've got this in this situation because there is a breach of a confidential, at least a confidential relationship, or a fiduciary or quasi-fiduciary duty, because there's trust placed and confidence placed upon the lessee to market the gas in good faith. We believe also that the court held that there was a distinct and separate tort pled and proven in the case, and that was by Texas Oil and Gas arranging a sale, a sham sale at the well with Delhi to deprive the plaintiffs of their royalties. This would be the constructive fraud theory, Castleberry versus Branscombe.
How much damages did the trial court give?
The trial court awarded $600,000 in damages.
Actual damages?
A little over $1 million in actual damages and $600,000 in exemplary damages, $250,000 of which the trial court allowed and granted as part of exemplary damages. That was in the trial court's findings and conclusions.
No, but you got to get actual damages before you get exemplary damages in a tort case. And what I want to know is how much did the trial court give you? Or all I need to know is did you make an award for actual damages on your tort claim?
Yes, sir. Now, their theory is going to be different because in the judgment, the trial court did not specify or base his reasons for that award of actual damages, as he did for attorney fees. But in the findings of fact and conclusions of law there, the trial court does indicate what those damages are.
And as part of them was for tort.
And we claim that they were. It's a matter of interpretation, but we claim that they were.
My recollection back pretty close.
TXO has claimed in their application under exemplary, on their points on exemplary damages, that the plaintiffs did not plead and prove that the attorney fees were paid or incurred. And of course the evidence is before this court here. We believe that there was substantial evidence on that point. They also raised that issue before the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals did not allow, overrule their point of error there. But there was evidence from Mrs. Hagen and Mr. Reeves about the events that took place after they started getting their royalty payments, how they were so low and how they started riding the company and couldn't get any satisfaction, so they got a meeting together of some 50 to 75 royalty owners, selecting a committee, deciding to hire attorneys and do whatever is necessary to bring a lawsuit if that was necessary. And they sent out letters to other royalty owners asking them to join them in the litigation and to contribute towards the cost of the lawsuit, and even received a large amount of funds to pay for the litigation. There was also the evidence of Mr. Buck Florence, who was a licensed attorney practicing law in Camp County, also a royalty owner, class member, and he testified that the $250,000 or 40% of recovery would constitute a reasonable, customary, and necessary fee. I'd like to address in response to their points, or their point 10 now, about the division order. I've talked about this some while ago, and I hate to bring this up segmented as it is, but there have been questions asked, and I've tried to respond to those questions. If this court will look at the division order closely in this case and compare it to the one in the Exxon versus Milton case, and the court's opinion in that case doesn't go into the specifics about that division order, the opinion of the Court of Appeals does. If you look at that, you'll see that the division order in this case is greatly different than the one in the Exxon versus Milton case. The division order in the Exxon versus Milton case authorized the lessee to make payments for all royalties in accordance with the division order. That language isn't in this division order. It stated that the royalty owners agreed to accept payments, so made in full payment of the royalties due them respectively. That provision is not in this division order. The order stipulated the marketing price upon which royalties would be paid. That provision is not in this division order. And that its execution was to be binding upon and inured to the benefit of the lessee. That provision is not in this division order. There's nothing in this division order that would put the royalty owners on notice that the gas was being sold to a subsidiary, the pricing of that gas, whether it was being sold off-premises or on-premises, nothing. There's no meeting of the minds as far as accepting royalties from them being in full satisfaction of their duty to pay royalties under any theory of liability that TXO may be under. I'd like to take a few minutes and address argument to the court under our conditional application. I'll try to make that brief. This court, the Court of Appeals did affirm liability in this case. They found that, the trial court did not make specific findings of fact on different on the prices at different times when the gas was sold. So the Court of Appeals could not determine whether or not gas prices exceeded the ceiling prices under the NGPA, which became effective in November of 1978. Also, there was nothing in the court's findings and conclusions which indicated whether or not or what the treating charges were or transportation charges. And if these had been deducted. Now, also the court went on to hold that we'd asked for attorney fees under Article 2226, and the court went on to hold that we did not prove that there had been proper presentment in this case to bring us underneath that article. We filed 3 points of error on those points. Number one, as far as the NGPA, there was ample evidence in the record to support the damages, the actual damages, based upon the difference in market value royalties and royalties that were actually paid before the NGPA ever went into effect in November of 1978.
Well, if you're asking about your cross points, you want the trial court affirmed in all respects. That's in the tax.
That's right. So we believe that the Court of Appeals was in error at that point. Although we could live by their ruling, we feel that since the evidence in the case showed that the market value prices, before you even get to the NGPA, allowed for the plaintiffs to recover the amount of actual damages that they recovered, that the Court of Appeals was in error in that regard. On the treating and transportation charges, the plaintiffs were being paid, were being charged 5.5 cents. May I have a few minutes of additional time, Your Honor?
What time is the count taken?
45 minutes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, you'll have to wrap up and sit down.
Okay. I would just ask the court to look at our brief closely. I believe that our points are well made, and we ask for the court to rule in accordance with the trial court's ruling.
Nothing personal intention. I believe you've covered everything thoroughly, but we have to have some reason for ruling. We did give you extra time, and I believe we'll have to live with that. Thank you.
Now, through the court, there's several responses I think that I should make here about some of the things that have been said. The order to do them in, I really don't know, but one of the more important things I think that needs to be considered is counsel's statement that there were three other purchasers who were willing to buy this gas at the time it was committed, if I understood him right. Now, they put on one expert witness, and I took him on cross-examination. I asked him some questions. I said, who else would have bought this gas out there? He said, well, Bystone Fuel Company, I think. But no, I don't know whether they had a line in the field land or not. I said, all right, name me another one. He said, Shell. I said, well, now, where is Shell? What does that do? He goes up to Ryan Mills Field. He never would tell or did tell what price Shell would have paid if we would have bought the gas. That is 30 miles away, and they were then, as the evidence shows, paying about 10 to 15, let's see, around 15 cents for this sour gas. Not this, but comparable sour gas, 13 to 15 cents. Ask him about any more. He said, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas coming. I said, all right. And he never could give a price about what they would pay. But we have a tax, and there is in the record, this was interstate gas subject to federal regulation. This was before the Natural Gas Policy Act. And they, the maximum they could have paid would have been 23 cents or 23 and a half cents. None of them would have been comparable to this price. I don't challenge everything. I want the court to look at the facts as much as they could, but those statements about there were other people ready to buy this gas are simply incorrect. And that's the fact about what it was, about what their expert testified to. I believe he said there was some testimony that the market value of this gas this time was 31 cents. But what their expert had done is just take all the charts available from the Comptroller's Office for Railroad Commission Districts 5 and Commission District 6. He'd take the three highest prices he found anywhere, he'd average them out, and he would come up with what he called a market value. And those values were based on one sale in Anderson County, over 100 miles from Missville, one sale in Hopkins County, has Sulphur Springs along with this field. They didn't have lines in this field to buy this gas. And there really was nobody else to buy it. And the prices were reasonable. Now he says that it's just not normal to sell this gas at the wells, and our expert witness testified that you couldn't buy the gas there. I mean that it's normally sold off the premises. That comes from one isolated piece of deposition testimony. And he asked him whether the gas was sold after it had first been treated. Mr. Key was the man, he's not living anymore, Homer Key, entire expert witness. He didn't even purport to know where this gas was sold. He was testifying as an expert witness. He said it was his understanding it was sold after it got out of the treating plant. He said that he thought that most sour gas, but there's nothing here to show that it's out of the ordinary to sell sour gas at a well. And as a matter of fact, there's other evidence in the record that shows that it is a common practice. Now, they speak of times and about how long ago they set up this wellhead contract, which is a very standard one, as evidence shows, to try to beat these people out of all this. I say the further back he goes, is the more detrimental his argument. The further you go, it indicates that you could have had less intention to deprive anybody of anything, much less their rightful royalties, if it's long prior to the time that the leases are even created in some instances. It took the combination of two standard practices and tried to convert them into what is called some basis for piercing the corporate veil.
Well, let me ask you, before you leave this reasonable price, and let's forget what anyone else could have done. Let's assume nobody else would have been around to pay any more. Were you paying a reasonable price for the gas that these folks, that was being taken?
Yes, I think the evidence...
Was there evidence in the record that you were not paying a reasonable price?
No, sir. I say there's not. The only evidence, it is party testimony, comes from Mr., I believe it's Wayne Miller. He said in this whole general area, no price is higher or higher had ever been paid for gas of this nature, and some of it had been sold in another part of an area. Speaking of the market for all this gas, for many years, there were these sour gas wells, which were a little further away, which you had to lay a lot of pipelines at, that never could find a market because it was this low BTU, high acid gas that had to be treated. It was too far away from the treating plant.
Did you finally get up to $1.60 some odd for this gas?
Oh, we got up to $2.75, the highest price you could pay at the time of trial. It was no time. We got, initially, we were committed to long-term contracts, so we spent. Dow High went to IPC and SWEPCO. Said, let's try to up the price, what we pay at the wellhead, and then you pay us more. They said, if you'll drill two more wells in that field, increase your reserve. If you get the producers to do it, we'll increase it. So they did, and they spent $1.5 million doing drilling those two wells. And that won them the right to get it redetermined every 2 years, the highest price paid in Commission District 6. They were paying that highest price, and they were paying $2.75 at the time of trial, and that was the maximum lawful price you could get. Their expert didn't know that, didn't know there was a maximum lawful price. He was finding the market value at $3.50 or something like that, which you can't do under the law, under the Bowers-Flowers case. It's federal case. And the prices are very handsome if you look through the years. There was a period of time after the contract was entered into there for a while where others were coming in paying more for new uncommitted gas. That's what that was on this Corpus Christi leasehold we talked about. He said at the same time, it was 9 months later. That contract was entered into in June 1973. 9 months after this, and it was new uncommitted gas, whereas this gas had already been committed and was committed to IPC and SWEPCO even a year before that.
Counsel, I have listened in vain for an explanation of why Delhi is in the chain of title to this gas.
Delhi,
it worked to keep the price down.
Why they're in the chain of title? Delhi is a gas buyer. It is the buying in, the pipeline in the business. And it buys gas not only from TSO, but from people, unrelated third parties, all through there. And it owns that whole East Texas gas gathering system, about 190 miles of pipeline. It buys it from many people, where TXO has some wells that sold production to them. That's why they're there. It was a market, a pipeline for the gas.
And TXO is a producer.
Yes, sir.
And Delhi takes care of all the pipeline treatment and pipeline facilities for TXO.
Not all of TXO. Sometimes TXO has sales, unrelated parties. Lots of times.
They buy gas and transmit gas for TXO and for other people.
For other people and for many others here, you know, the record. And other persons. They just their pipeline subsidiary.
They own the refinery?
Delhi own
the plant.
Yes, they own the facility. Now it's true that there are payments that are made by TXO sometimes for some and charged back on intercompany accounts. Not all of them, as he said. The record shows that Delhi itself paid for a lot of these pipelines, these easements, a lot of things through their own drafts. I think in all these contracts, except one contract where they constructed these facilities, all of them for construction, the gathering line, the field, all of it, this is in Delhi's name. I don't regard it so important as to whose name it's in. I think the important thing is whether this relationship has ever been used to create an inequitable result for anybody. And it really hasn't. I can't see where it is. We've counted to them. This gas is sold at the wellhead to Delhi, who never got anything but 13 and a half to 15 cents difference the whole time.
You've got to keep the sulfur.
How's that?
You've got to keep the sulfur on the payroll.
Might use this device,
if you
not. Keep what on the payroll?
The sulfur.
Oh, yes, sir. And the record shows that it costs much, much more to take the sulfur out of it, to sweeten this gas, than any revenues that ever came back from it. And as a matter of fact, I think it's common, not anybody rather have the sweet gas than the sour gas. But they got to take in sour gas when the price of energy went up. This well, first well here, had been drilled and capped by ARCO looking for an oil well. And it was a sour gas well. They capped it. Came back years later and re-entered the well. And the moving, if I may, to a few other things that...
Before you do, I'd like to see if I understand what you're saying the result of your own rule would be, the rule you want us to announce, and that is, take out what Judge Cornelius has said about higher faith and duty to go and reasonably prudent operator to the market. What kind of a case do you have to make under that rule to just say, you're not paying me enough for the gas, you're not meeting the reasonably prudent operator rule?
They would have to show the parties and the circumstances as they existed at the time the contract was entered into. And whether or not you committed it to a contract which was fair and reasonable at that time under those circumstances.
You don't have a continuing duty to continue to monitor the market and see if there ought to be some changes made?
Not if you've entered into a contract. It's about the only type of contract you can get, which is a long-term contract, which is what parties entered into in 1970, as well as 1972. It's what was reasonable at the time. But you have a duty to get the best price you can, and as here, we went out and drilled and spent a lot more money. I'm talking about TXO, $1.5 million, drilled two more wells to get higher prices and kick them the highest price you could get.
Were the royalties paid on that higher price?
Oh, yes. And Delhi's still not getting a thing different. It's 13 and a half, 15 cents. We're getting the best that this electric utility, SWEPCO, and the International Paper Company would let us get for boiler fuel. This gas would come up to 700, 750.
Were these arguments made to the jury, the ones you're making now?
To the court, to the trial court.
I'm sorry.
You got me back to the jury twice. And finally, let's see. As far as the question of fact about in the middle of the gas, he says the question of fact where gas is sold, that's just exactly the opposite. You'll recall in Ted Butler versus Exxon, Hank Grody testified, some of those fellows, that gas could be considered a wellhead sale even if it's really technically off the lease premises. And they had there called it a question of fact. In the Midland case, they said it's not a question of fact. Just exactly opposite. They said, no, sir. That gas is sold at tailgate of plant. There's no question. You can't get expert testimony in here and start telling me. That's, depending by Judge Campbell, it's not sold off the premises. Now, there's no question, but they're just 180 degrees out of phase. That is not a question of fact. And that's particularly so when the instrument, pursuant to what has happened, is plain and unambiguous. There is the provision for a wellhead sale here. As to constructive fraud, just mentioned, you cite Archer versus Griffith. In the opinion, Archer versus Griffith cites different circumstances about where constructive fraud usually arises. It's usually in a very close relationship between people. And the fact that you may have a parent selling to a subsidiary, that is a factor to be considered. But if the parent is selling to the subsidiary at the highest price attainable or at a reasonable price, that does not taint the transaction. It's just one factor to be considered.
Your argument primarily is that when this contract was entered into, that there was no sales of gas at all. It couldn't be until you built the plant.
I think there were no sales. There had been in an area right away, but no sales in this immediate area.
And your plant is going to be the owner plant.
Well, our plant, and it's one we constructed by the Getty and U-Hope, it wasn't altogether ours. It's some jointly owned plant, but it processed sour gas from various places.
There was no sale for that sour gas, though, until you built the plant.
For this particular sour gas, that's right. There would have been no market for it at this, in this specific area. In some wells, the evidence showed it never found a market.
That's why you capped the well to start with, is that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's why you capped the well to start with. ARCA capped the well.
Yeah, ARCA capped the well. That's why they did. Plus the fact that then, when they drilled this first well, it just, I don't know how much the record showed, there just was no market for sour gas at all.
How far away was the closest sweetening plant?
From here at that time?
Yeah.
I don't know. He mentioned there were 17 facilities in East Texas, but what the point is, that sour gas is very dangerous gas, it's shown, and it's not an acceptable practice to haul it for a very long distance at all. And that completely disproves any theory that we could have flown this gas 100 miles away in East Texas or something else. I don't know what the closest facility was, but it had to be at least 30 miles away, besides this one plant. All right, I think I've taken enough of the court's time here, and there were some more things I wanted to say, but I either said it's not enough or too much, so I appreciate it.
All experienced counsel have done a very good job, as we would have expected. That will complete...